Please continue eating and enjoying the conversation around your table for a second, but we do want to maximize the opportunity that we have to hear from John Wood today. I don't know about you, but I got my very first copy of Leaving Microsoft to Change the World back either in the late spring or early summer of 2007. And I say I got my first copy because ever since then, it seems like about once every month or two, somebody else is putting another copy of this book into my hands and saying, have you read this yet? You've got to be sure that you read this book. It's going to change your life. John, I have to admit, I've never bought a copy of the book, but but I've over time, I've had a bookshelf full, and I keep passing them out to other people as well, so we're spreading the word for you. It is an incredible privilege for us to have John Wood with us here today on behalf of everyone here at Communities Foundation of Texas, along with all our colleagues, collaborators, cohorts who are involved in this luncheon today, Dallas Social Venture Partners, of course, the Entrepreneurs Foundation of North Texas, the Dallas Foundation, the Dallas Women's Foundation, everyone that has come together to make this possible. We are proud to stand alongside you and to open our doors for this event. I will bet you that by the time this lunch is over today, we will have forgotten that it is a cold, wet, and dreary day outside. And instead, I bet we're going to leave here with a renewed sense of passion and conviction about the work that we do every day to invest in the lives of other people. So let me get out of the way so that you can catch some of that passion and conviction from John and turn the program over now to Stacy Caldwell with Dallas Social Venture Partners to get us underway. Please welcome Stacy.
Good morning. Thank you all for coming out today in your rowboats, speedboats, tugboats, however you got here. I have the honor of introducing John Wood, and I was able to see John with another group of partners I hang out with called Social Venture Partners International. Last October in Ohio, John spoke to the group of international partners, and we have a very similar beginning as the founder of Social Venture Partners is another Microsoft executive who became a social entrepreneur. So I'm very excited to share this with you. You're in for a treat. John founded Room to Read in 2000. He left Microsoft at the age of 35 and was deeply concerned at that time that nearly 1 billion people lack the basic literacy, and that over 200 million children in the developing world are not enrolled in school. During his career at Microsoft, he ran significant parts of the company's international business division, including positions as director of marketing for the Asia-Pacific division, marketing for Microsoft Australia, and director of business development for the greater China region. He holds a Master of Business Administration from the Kellogg Graduate School of Management at Northwestern University, a BS in Finance from the University of Colorado, and an honorary doctorate in Human Letters from the University of San Francisco. I could keep going on and on. I have three pages of these amazing awards and recognitions that he's received. But more importantly, the way that I look at John is he is a pioneer in the world of social entrepreneurship. And if you haven't heard that term before, it's not going to be the last time. Social entrepreneurs are those individuals in our communities and around the world who are applying their business skills and tools from the business sector to impact their communities and issues that we face. So I would like to skip all of the accolades and point you to their website so that you can hear directly from John and be inspired by his story. Thank you.
Good afternoon. Accolades are only good if you earn them. So my charter in the next half hour is to actually show that our team is worthy of that. And also thank you for the challenge of competing against this weather. That's quite a challenge. If somebody could drop the lights, these kids are much better looking than I am. So I'd rather that the kids stand out during the presentation. And it's just great to see so many of you here. I do hope we can kind of have a reality suspension zone for the next half hour and close our eyes and journey to different parts of the world where Room to Read is working. For me, it's great to be back here. This is kind of a homecoming for me because my parents actually met in the Dallas-Fort Worth area in the mid-1950s. My mother is from Duluth, Minnesota. My father is from Denver. Colorado. They both came here during the boom in the 50s, and so without Dallas-Fort Worth, it's actually Fort Worth, not Dallas, but without Dallas, the Dallas-Fort Worth area, I wouldn't be around today, and nor would Room to Read. The second Dallas connection Mary and I was talking about is that actually Melinda Gates was my hiring manager. So without Melinda, I wouldn't have gone to Microsoft. Without Microsoft, there'd be no stock options. Without stock options, there'd be no risk-taking. And without risk-taking, there'd be no Room to Read. So in a shameless ploy to get all of you on my side, I thought I'd just make those quick Dallas connections before I start, and hopefully you'll make me an honorary Dallas resident. The story of how Room to Read got started, many of you know, but it's really for me the story of what I call the accidental philanthropist. I had no idea that I would be up here talking one day about building libraries and schools across the poorest parts of the world. I went to Nepal in 1998 as a burned out Microsoft executive. I'd had a 7.5-year run during one of the busiest boom times in the technology, in the history of the technology industry. A friend of mine took me to a slideshow, and we saw this incredible 18-day 200-mile trekking opportunity called the Annapurna Circuit. How many of you have trekked in the Himalayas? Okay, about 6 or 7 of you, it looks like. Incredible place, no cell phones, no email coverage, no roads, no cars, just peace, just an incredible place to trek. Along with that, though, is poverty. The irony of places like Nepal is these mountains, while they're beautiful to look at, create harsh conditions, hard to grow crops, no roads, hard to trade with your neighbors. The nearest school might be 3 miles away, but that 3 miles away might be over a 12 or 13,000 foot mountain pass, so kids don't go to school. I didn't know any of this. I was fortunate enough on my first day of trekking to meet a gentleman by the side of the trail. His name was Pasupati Niyapani. He was the district resource officer for this province in Nepal, and he told me he was going to visit a school the next day, and would I like to come along? I eagerly assented. I thought this would be a chance to see the real Nepal, not the tourist Nepal. So I met him the next morning for tea. We proceeded to cross a very scary set of bridges that connected the donkey trails together that led to this little village called Bahundanda. Nepal is a difficult place to go if you have vertigo. This was an incredible bridge. I got halfway across this bridge and heard somebody shouting. I looked up and saw a train of donkeys coming across at us on the other side of the bridge. And as you know, donkeys don't have a reverse gear, so we kind of hastily scrambled back to our side of the bridge. At the end of this bridge was a school that would, for me, forever change my life. This was a school that we visited in the village called Bahundanda. I could not believe that kids were being asked to learn in these conditions. A sheet metal roof that heated the room to about 120 degrees during the summer. The sheet metal roof that leaked during the rainy season, turning the dirt floor to mud. The inside of the school looked even worse than the outside of the school. And this is kind of poverty writ large. It's poverty in the developing world, not just hurts the adults, but it hurts the kids the hardest because it robs them of the opportunity to make the best of themselves and the best of their lives. The headmaster of the school, after showing me the classrooms, invited me to come see the school's library. And I was fairly naive. I thought the library would be something like this. You know, you got kids reading books, right? Isn't that happy? How many of you were library nerds as kids? Yeah, quite a, wow, that's the highest proportion I've ever seen anywhere. It's great you can admit that. I am proud to say that I was a library nerd as a kid. And so when I got to the library, I was quite shocked to see that it was a library in name only. It was a space where theoretically a library could have existed, except for lack of chairs, lack of desks, and most importantly, lack of books. And I didn't want to be obnoxious because Lord knows there's enough obnoxious Americans traipsing around the developing world asking silly questions, but I had to ask. I said, "This is a beautiful library. Thank you for showing it to me. Where exactly do you keep the books hidden?" And the headmaster pointed to a cabinet in the back of the room with a padlock on it, and he said, "The books are so precious we cannot let the children harm them." If you're a fan of irony, you know, locking up the books. Well, they found the teacher who unlocked the cabinet, and they had probably about 20 books. They had 450 students, so a terrible ratio of books to students, but worse than the quantity was the quality. These were books that backpackers had thoughtfully left behind. But obviously when you backpack through Nepal, you're not carrying Dr. Seuss or Clifford the Big Red Dog in your backpack, so the books were not appropriate for kids. I'm no literary snob. I think every child should read Danielle Steele romance novels at some point of their pedagogical development. And what kid doesn't enjoy reading James Joyce's Ulysses at age 6 or 7? But the headmaster spoke a sentence, and for those of you who have read my book, you may recall that chapter 1 is titled, "Perhaps, Sir, You Will Someday Come Back with Books." That was the headmaster's very simple request. And as a library nerd who had made some money and was looking for something to do with that money, and I didn't want to do a handout, I wanted to do a hand up, it hit me that this was a great opportunity. So I told the headmaster, I'll be back. One of his teachers looked at me skeptically and said, many of you Trekkers tell us you'll come back, and we never see any of you again. So he'd thrown down the gauntlet. So I thought about this for days and days and days on end. On day 9 of my trek, I got this vision in the middle of the night. And I may have gotten the vision because I was drinking the local alcohol at 14,000 feet of altitude, but you have to take your visions where you can get them in life. And my vision was Carnegie. Carnegie, as we all know, has one of the greatest philanthropic legacies of all time, 2,509 community libraries across North America. Why nobody has replicated Carnegie, why there's not been a version 2.0 of Carnegie, is completely beyond me. Why do we fail to learn from those who go before us who make smart investments? I didn't have a lot of resources, but I knew that I had enough to at least be Carnegie in one village or two villages or three villages. So I vowed I'd go back, and I pulled out my journal that night, and I started to write the email I'd send to friends that would go around the world that actually would start Room to Read. And it's amazing to think about the power you can send out into the universe, that hitting send on that one email to collect books led to my parents, who I hadn't really informed of the scale of my dreams, and then my parents were the book collection point in North America, became inundated with books. They were receiving literally thousands of books from friends around the world who said, I've traveled in the developing world, I've seen the kids, I want to help. So the books were flooding in to my parents' home, and at one point my dad emailed me and said, you need to get home soon. This thing's kind of spinning out of control. I wanted to go back to Nepal and do the Carnegie thing, and the goal was to really do a latter-day version of Carnegie, and actually I wanted to be Carnegie with a yak. I thought that the yak would be this iconic scale of our dreams, that a mere human porter or a mere donkey would not be big enough. If kids want to read, you got to have yak-sized proportions of books. So this is Zach the Yak. Many of you know from my book that this was the iconic book delivery trip. You'll notice we rented Zach the Yak for $5 a day. And the guide rope is actually shorter than Zach the Yak's horns, which led me to believe that the Microsoft Windows development team had been in Nepal before me designing guide ropes. My 73-year-old father announced his intentions to go with me to Nepal, much to my surprise. My dad said, I'm going with you to deliver the books. And I'm like, Dad, that's a crazy idea. And my mother said, no, it's a great idea. Take your dad to Nepal. Get him out of the house. My dad, like many American men, was failing at the whole notion of retirement. He didn't have enough hobbies. He'd been alphabetizing her spice cabinet because it was a chaos. And so my mother encouraged him to go with me. So I tried to talk him out of it, and he said, no, 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 no. I said, no, Dad, you got to trek for days, and it's dirty, and you don't have television, and you can't eat meat, and gave him all these reasons he couldn't go. And then about a month later, I got an email from my father. I was back in Sydney. And he wrote me an email and said, Dear John, I just posted 37 boxes of books off to Nepal. There are over 3,000 books. Send me a check for $785 when you get a chance. You should be very proud of this project. It's going to help a lot of kids in Nepal. Your mother and I are very proud of you. Love, Dad. P.S. Can you explain to me again why I can't go with you? I felt like such a jerk. So I wrote back to my dad and said, you know what? I'm sending you money. Buy a ticket. Meet me in Bangkok. We'll fly together to Kathmandu. And he wrote back and said, well, since I'm so old and feeble, why don't you make it a business class ticket? So my hubris cost me $4,000. Had a great trip with my dad. I don't know if any of you have traveled alone, solo, with an adult parent, as an adult yourself, in the developing world for a week. If you have not, you should, because if I had to do it, you should have to do it too. No, actually, it was incredibly fun. It brought my dad and I so close together. And the first village that we visited, the kids were excited. And the second village, the kids were excited. They'd heard we were coming. They were stringing marigold garlands to welcome us and hanging them around our neck. And then back in the village of Bahundanda, we thought we'd get all the kids to line up and have each kid accept the books and kind of walk them into the library. And as you can see from this photo, our queuing kind of failed miserably. The kids didn't get the notion that they shouldn't just be, they were like stage diving onto the books. It was like literacy palooza. The kids were hurling themselves. And they were so excited. These kids had never seen brightly colored children's books before. And they were looking at the first time they'd ever seen African wildlife, or the first time they'd ever gone underneath the ocean to look at the creatures and the sharks, and kids looking at the solar system, and a boy who didn't know that man had walked on the moon. And to me, that just was so incredible to think to myself, I'd have done something so small. And one of the teachers came up to me, and he held my hand, and he said, you have given us so much, and we can give you so little in return. And I'm sure all of you have had that moment, right, where somebody says that to you and you realize that you've gotten a lot more than you've given. And sitting with my dad that night, I said, there's so much more we need to do. We cannot keep this thing small. There are tens of thousands of villages that need this. So at that point, the seed was planted for me to kind of blow up my life and leave Microsoft, and everybody thought I was crazy, and people told me I was having a midlife crisis, and I said, I'm 35 years old. That's technically too young. Maybe I'm having an early life crisis, but I need to do this because books and libraries and education were so important to my own family's path out of poverty. So it was a time to really pay it forward. So Room to Read started, officially launched about just over nine years ago in January 2000. The core belief of the organization is very simple, summarized in these six words. World change starts with educated children. If you want to change the world, there's no better place to start than by educating children, because education is the issue that has the ripple effect. It is the issue that affects every other issue. It affects the path out of poverty. It affects family health. It affects family income. It affects maternal death during childbirth. It affects political participation. So if you want to start by dropping a pebble into a pond and watching the ripples go out, education, in my belief, is the best place to start. I know talking to many of you during the half hour of book signing, many of you are involved in great education programs. So the idea for us was to take this and scale it massively, to not be content to do one library or 10 libraries, but to look at the need that was out there and go attack what I think of as the grand challenges of education in the developing world. There are three what I see as grand challenges, and Stacy mentioned these in the opening presentation. The first of which is that this morning, 250 million little people woke up, and they did not put on a school uniform, they did not grab their backpack, they did not walk to school with a smile on their face, they did not sit at the desk, and they did not learn. That happened yesterday, it's happening today, it's going to happen tomorrow, unless we get out there and do something about that. I don't believe we should allow this. This, to me, should be a non-negotiable. Every child everywhere should go to school. As Stacy mentioned, 800 million people in the world today are illiterate. 98% of that 800 million are in the developing world. The headmaster in Nepal explained to me, he said, we are too poor to afford education, but until we have education, we will always be poor. That's the catch-22 of the developing world. Over a billion kids in the world today don't have access to a proper library. So that's the second grand challenge. And then the third grand challenge is that two-thirds of these groups of illiterate and out of school are girls and women. And this is a problem, of course, that pays itself forward in perpetuity. How many of us have a mother who read to us? Yeah, almost every hand in the audience went up. What if your mother couldn't read? What if your mother hadn't gone to school? What if your mother didn't value school or hadn't gone herself? So three big challenges we're trying to tackle. We want to tackle them with quality. We want to tackle them at significant scale. We're hoping to go to a scale that has never before been seen in the world, because human progress demands that all of us try to do things that have never been done before. To go attack those three grand challenges, and we don't really view them as problems, we view them as opportunities, not to be too much like Tony Robbins, but you know, there are problems and there are opportunities. We view this as an opportunity to do three things, and to do them well and to do them at scale. Number one is to build schools across the developing world, to make sure kids have access to schools, make sure that the government is working with us to provide teachers to those schools so that they're not empty shells, but they're very vibrant ecosystems full of kids and full of teachers, and I'll explain more about that. That's our first program, School Room. The second program is called Reading Room. This is setting up bilingual libraries in schools that exist already, in orphanages that exist already through partnerships, in our own schools. Pretty much anywhere kids congregate, our goal is to set up a bilingual collection of books that are local language plus English, so kids can grow up literate and fluent in two languages. And then third is our girls' scholarship program that gives long-term scholarships to girls to invite them in and make sure the girls go to school and to stay in school. Now, to be clear, we're not anti-boy. As a former boy myself, I do not want to be anti-boy. The schools are gender neutral, but when you build a school in the developing world, you figure out quickly that more boys are showing up than girls. Libraries also gender neutral. More boys show up than girls. So the scholarship program is designed to alleviate that discrepancy between boys' participation rates and girls' participation rates. So please don't worry that we're anti-boy. We're not. We're pro-boy, pro-girl. The business model of Room to Read is built to have high-quality programs that are locally run, locally controlled, where parents have skin in the game, where we can scale massively. I am a bore about the subject of scale because the world's problems today are so huge. And a lot of other people are filling those vacuums with things they shouldn't be filled with. So the whole idea of Room to Read is to build it around scale. I have no idea what the girl with the chicken has to do with scale, by the way. There's no chickens involved in our scale. But this girl was so cute, I had to come somehow get her into my slideshow. So anyway, there's a couple key parts of our business model I'll go through for those of you who are kind of building or dissecting or constantly changing your own business model. These are the things that I've learned in the last 9 years of running Room to Read, and a lot of these are things that I've tried to take out of my business career, out of learning from Microsoft, out of learning from following Steve Ballmer around and watching Steve's way of building Microsoft and watching Bill's way of building Microsoft to say, how can you apply this to the social sector? The first and most important is having strong local teams, having the equivalent of your local CEO and your local CEO's team. We do not send expats overseas. We do not send volunteers overseas. We build indigenous capacity. This is super important to me because it's the Vietnamese who know how things should work in Vietnam, who speak the language. It's the South Africans who know how things should work in South Africa. And it's the Nepalese who know how things should work in Nepal. 80% of our employees are local, national, close to the customer. They work for a lot less than an expat would work for. But more importantly, they're going to be there for years and years and years, 724-365. So I tell the country directors that technically I work for them. My job is to get them branding, to get them recognition, to get them resources, to get them money so that they can go big and go to scale. So that's the first part of our model. When I talk about our results, it's not really about me or my team. It's really about these teams who are out there getting the results. Those local teams then engage the community through what we call challenge grants. The idea behind the challenge grant is very simple, that the parents have to have skin in the game. The parents have to have rolled up their sleeves and donated and dedicated sweat equity to each and every project. We all know the saying, you cannot help people who don't want to help themselves. That's one of my number one rules of philanthropy, is unless the local people are being required to put skin in the game, there's no sense doing the project. And those of us who have traveled in the developing world, many of you have probably seen these failed projects where people drop a bunch of stuff off, they pray that it works, they leave, there's no monitoring, there's no evaluation, there's no follow-up, there's no training, there's no growth in the human capacity and the human capital. So what we do is tell the parents, if you want a school, you will work to help us build the school. This is a village called Katrak in the Nepalese Himalayas. I walked up here in 2002 and was almost run off the trail by the mothers. The mothers had 110-pound bags of cement on their backs. They were up before sunrise, walking down the hill for an hour, the donkey trail, back up the donkey trail. And these women could not have weighed 110 pounds themselves. They still had to go work in the fields for the day, but they were up early because they want their kids to have education. The fathers on the building site also working, digging the foundation. I was in a school in Laos 2 weeks ago, and I found out at the school two things. Number one is when they did the groundbreaking, they ran out of shovels. They had more parents than they had shovels. That is a classic great problem to have when your parents are that engaged. If you ever go to a PTA meeting and there's too many parents in the room, wow, that's a great thing. Certainly better than too little. Secondly, at the school in Nepal, I found out that there were 3,000 families who had each contributed 10,000 kip. It's about $1.20. But 3,000 families had each given 10,000 kip. It was harder for them to come up with that 10,000 kip than it was for our donor from Japan to write his check for $35,000 as his contribution to the school. Kenji was there at the school, so he actually got to meet the parents who had put their money in. So that challenge grant is a very important part of our work. When we open a library, we ask the parents, what can you do? Can you lay down the flooring? Can you build the shelves? Can you paint the inside? What will you do? So the third part of the business model is to make small amount of money go a long way. We all know that resources are limited. Why do education in the developing world when we have other priorities that are out there? Well, I would say that one of the reasons we should do it is because we can stretch a dollar incredibly far. I will never be able to afford to endow a building at Colorado or at Northwestern, unfortunately. That's just my reality of my financial situation. I've endowed several schools in the developing world because we can go to a village like this, and don't worry, this is not our school you see here. This is a school we tore down. This is what the inside of that school looked like, 75 kids crammed into a room, and thank God the teacher is thin because there's barely room for the teacher to stand up in front. But for the equivalent of about $30,000, we were able to build an entire building using local labor, using donations of local land, using donations of local materials, and basically set up an entire school for kids. So not a lot of money going a long, long way. A freestanding library like this that actually builds the building, sets up all the books, the shelves, the librarian training, the monitoring and evaluation, etc. Again, not a lot of money to create massive change. And then at a smaller scale, when you take it down to the individual girl level, the scholarship, you can fund a girl for a year for $250. That changes a life forever. That's less than a dollar a day. So why is this not being done more? Why do we live in a world where we have literally 150 million little girls waking up this morning and not going to school? Because the desire is there, the cost is not high, and I'll ask all the women in the audience, I don't want to marginalize this as a women's issue, but can we make this the cause for women in the next decade? Can we actually take and attack this problem at scale and not rest and not sleep and not be satisfied until every little girl everywhere in the world goes to school? For $250 a year, $20 a month, whatever you look at it, you give the girl school fees, her uniform, her shoes, her bicycle, mentoring, tutoring, health care, a lunch stipend if she needs it, a transportation stipend if she needs it, ongoing monitoring and evaluation. But most importantly, you give the girl her ridiculously oversized Room to Read backpack. We have very, very big ambitions for our girls, and if they decide they want to read Tolstoy and Dostoevsky at some point, they will actually have room in their backpacks. So our goal with this program is very simple. It is to just scale to the point where we have 10,000 girls and then 20,000 and then 40,000 and 80,000 and just keep growing it and growing it and growing it. It doesn't take much money to do it. The fourth key part of the business model is a direct link between what gets invested and what gets done. There's a reason I flashed those pictures and the price points up there, because in the developing world, quite often people give money away and they have no idea where the money went. What happened to that money? Was that used to fly around in first class? Was that money being used in a good way? What we do with all of our starter donations is to say, tell us what you want to do, and we will show you the result of it. We've had hundreds of families endow schools. And when I say endow, it's a one-off payment and then they're done. The schools are self-sustaining by the community. But it holds our hand to the flame to say, you better deliver. Because you told that person you're going to open a school in Nepal or a school in Vietnam or a school in Laos or a library in South Africa in their name. So that direct link is there. Our investors, I don't call them donors, I call them investors. Our investors go and they visit the projects. They're the guests of honor. This was taken 2 weeks ago in Laos. We had three different investors with us who had actually funded schools and were there for the opening ceremony. A lot of investors now bring their kids to teach their kids philanthropy, to say, hey, kids, let's actually set up a school somewhere in the developing world. We'll follow its progress because Room to Read sends us reports and sends us photos. And if we want to go visit it, we can go visit it. If you can't visit it, we still send you the photos and send you the report. The fifth key part of the business model is this, monitoring and evaluation. It's really important that we hold ourselves accountable and collect the data in a way that Jim Collins in Good to Great would respect. You collect the data, you analyze the data, you figure out what's going well, what's going badly. Are the teachers showing up? How many students are showing up? How many hours a week is the library open? Is the librarian trained? Is the librarian training other librarians? What percent of school libraries have a checkout system? What percent of girls are passing to the next grade? What's the attrition rate for girls? Data, data, data. And then you analyze it and you figure out what you can do better. And you can always do better because this work is hard. You're working in very difficult, resource-starved communities. So it's important to invest heavily in the monitoring and evaluation. I'll just give you one example of this. With every library we set up this year, we will visit it 12 times during the next 3 years, quarterly, to check out the conditions and make sure the library is being well-run, well-utilized, and if there are problems, we can intervene. I will say also, it's very hard to find a sexy photograph of monitoring and evaluation. This is about as good as it gets. I'll also say, as a founder of an NGO, is that a lot of investors want you to do monitoring and evaluation, but they usually don't want to pay for it. So if you are giving money to charities and you do want them to do monitoring and evaluation, just carve off 10 or 20% of what you give them and say, hey, if I put some money into monitoring and evaluation, will that help you? Sixth part of our business model is dreaming big. At Microsoft, we used to say, go big or go home. If you're going to do something, do it well. If you're going to launch an office suite, don't aim for 10 or 20% market share. Aim for 80 or 85 or 90% market share and go big. Our go big or go home statistic from last year, I'm quite proud of. We opened about 2,000 libraries last year alone. It was over four new libraries per day. It was a new library every 6 hours. So what that looked like was between lunch and dinner, a library had opened. You like that PowerPoint effect? Between the time you went to sleep and the time you woke up, a new library had opened. Between the time my flight left New York and it landed in San Francisco, assuming strong headwinds, a new library had opened. between the time I got on my last United Airlines flight and the time it actually took off, we'd actually opened a new library. So we're starting to reach that scale where you're saying, wow, it's not one library, it's not five, it's not 10, it's not one school, it's dozens, it's hundreds, and you keep growing and growing and growing. In fact, we grew so fast that in our seventh year, we started to do an analysis. And we said, well, let's look at the business sector. When they see opportunity, they scale. The charity sector, unfortunately, usually likes to stay small and grassroots and keep it really small. We would like to go bigger. So we compared ourselves to the kings of scalability. And we said, well, you know, if the world needs a good latte, the world damn well needs literacy. So if these guys can scale, well, let's go head-to-head and look at our numbers and see how we compare. So we actually looked at Starbucks post-IPO, new outlets. We looked at Room to Read's first 8 years, new libraries open. And what you see here is you see Starbucks in yellow, and you see Room to Read in green. In the first couple of years, they're kind of kicking our ass. In the third year, we're pulling even. In the fourth year, we're ahead. In years 5, 6, 7, and 8, we're actually out-Starbucking Starbucks. So if anybody ever asks you if you can take your idea to scale, I hope you will tell them about the Starbucks test and the fact that an NGO has actually found a way to grow faster than a well-run, well-financed, for-profit company. It is definitely possible. And then the final two parts of the business model are efficiency of operations. I know how hard it was to get marketing dollars out of Steve Ballmer. You had to sweat for your marketing budget. You had to make absolutely a clear case how you're going to spend your money. I believe that same thing should be done in a charity world. At Room to Read, we try to keep our costs as low as possible. So, for example, here's our team in Phnom Penh delivering books to one of our libraries, and our poor employee is almost hanging off the back of the tuk-tuk. He's so overstuffed it with books. This is our team in rural Cambodia delivering books, a 65-pound mobile book cart plus books to a rural library on rented motorbikes. Now, what's missing from this photo? Anybody? Shoes, yeah. Helmets, yeah. What else? Children, yeah. Roads, yeah, there's a road missing. That's kind of a road, at least during the dry season. What I think is the most important thing that's missing is this beast right here. We have the no land river policy at Room to Read. Throughout the developing world, you see parking lots in front of the pub that are filled with Land Rovers and Range Rovers, every one of which costs $75,000. Think about that a minute. Divide $75,000 by $250 per girl per year. That's 300 girls who don't go to school in a year. That's 60,000 girl days of education that you cannot fund if you buy one of these things. Imagine if you buy 10 or 15 or 20. So one of the ways we try to keep our overhead low is by being creative. Credit Suisse gives us office space in London and Hong Kong. My board chairman at one point bragged to me that he had 3 million frequent flyer miles. He doesn't anymore. We negotiate with hotels around the world to get free nights when we're in a certain city, Tokyo or Hong Kong, and then at the event we do a shout out to them. Works well for them, works well for us. It's an example of low overhead. That's allowed us to deploy over the last 5 years about 87 cents in the dollar directly to programs. We're less than half the charitable average for overhead expenses. You have to have some overhead. The challenge is how do you make sure you don't have too much? How do you maintain your 4-star ranking? We are one of the charities that's gotten a 4-star ranking every single time Charity Navigators ranked us. There's only 10% of charities in the U.S. that can claim that. So we're very proud of that. Finally, part of the business model that I'm most excited about is this entrepreneurial network of fundraising chapters we have around the world. One of the reasons our overhead is low is that we have chapters in 39 cities around the world where 3,000 people give their time to Room to Read. And when they volunteer to go out and fundraise for schools, for scholarships, for local language books, whatever it might be. From Austin to Boston to Chicago to Dubai and through to Zurich, we have fundraising chapters all around the world. Now we don't, that dot down there, by the way, is Austin. We don't have a dot on Dallas yet. We don't have a dot on Houston yet. So if you like what you see and you want to get involved, I'm easy to find. I'm John at roomtoread.org, I'm Wood at roomtoread.org, I'm Jay Wood at roomtoread.org, and I'm John.Wood at roomtoread.org. And we would love to have more of a presence in Texas. This volunteer chapter network raises 35% of our budget year on year. By the end of this year, they'll have raised over $20 million during the last 5 years. Entrepreneurial, self-run, volunteers, people who are busy, but if you want to get something done, you ask a busy person. So that's a key part of our model. I'm going to close just very briefly with just a couple of quick stories about the students that we're serving, the communities we're serving. I talk a lot about numbers, and I was told by our Ketchum, which is our pro bono PR firm, pro bono being our favorite Latin phrase, that I need to also not forget to bring it down to actually the kids that we are helping. So just a couple of quick stories. This is Debbie Taru. You would not know from the 20-megawatt smile on her face that her background actually was as a slave, as an indentured servant. She's part of a caste in Nepal called the Kamlari caste. The Kamlari caste is traditionally sells their daughters into indentured servitude to the middle class. Working with a partner of ours, the Nepalese Youth Opportunity Foundation, Debbie Taru was freed by NYOF. She's one of 400 girls who was freed 2 years ago by NYOF. They didn't have the money to pay for the scholarship, so we said, sign us up. We'll put every one of those girls into a bridge course that goes through grades 1 through 3. We'll give every one of those girls a scholarship guaranteed through the end of secondary school as long as they pass. These girls went through, Debbie Taru being an example. She's now in the top quarter of her class in fourth grade. She's been mainstreamed into the system. This year, we are grabbing another 300 girls out of indentured servitude and putting them in school. So we'll have 700 versions of Debbie Taru who are out there, whose lives will be changed from watching the children of their masters go to school while they wash dishes or scrub clothes to actually grabbing their backpack every day and walking to school. That's the kind of change we can create, and I think that's the kind of change we should create. This is a shot taken in the Mekong Delta of Vietnam at one of our school opening ceremonies. The two girls here, Alex and Juliana, are part of our Lakeside High School chapter. We have a program called Students Helping Students, where over 200 schools around the world raise money for Room to Read projects, and many of them actually go visit their projects. These girls did an event where they collectively raised $700,000 in an evening by monetizing their parents. If you're a parent, that probably scares you. But these kids are really entrepreneurial. 11 girls and one very strategic boy were on the committee. I took Alex and Juliana with me on a Vietnam trip so they could actually see their work. They could see a library being open and see what it feels like to have 1,000-plus kids who benefit from a library that's being opened. Of course, no library should be opened without a fleet of cheerleaders who are there cheering for literacy. But at this library opening, what really struck me was a little kid who came up to me. He was about 14 years old, and he stuck out his hand, and he gave me a firm handshake like he was going to sell me an insurance policy. And he looked me in the eye, and he said, "Hello, Mr. John Wood. My name is Tron." He said, "I have a simple goal, Mr. John Wood. My goal is to read every single book in this library. First, I will read every book in Vietnamese. Then I'll read every book in English. What do you think of my goal, Mr. John Wood?" And I said, "That's an ambitious goal. I love it. But do you really think you can do it? There's 1,000 books in this library." And he said, "It is no problem, Mr. John Wood. I came in here last night. I have already read 9 books." And it's really for students like him that I think all of us work so hard at Room to Read. When people say, "Why do you work for a lot less money than you could make? Why do you travel so much?" It's because there's literally tens of millions of kids like this who are out there who want a chance. And if we can give them a chance, I think they'll become self-sufficient and break the cycle of poverty in this generation. The headmasters are equally dedicated. The teachers are equally dedicated. This is our 6th school, and it was built, Don and Terry, in Dading Province in Nepal. My board co-chair, Hillary Valentine, whose father founded a couple of successful companies through Sequoia Capital, like Yahoo, YouTube, Google, Electronic Arts, and a few others, had this school dedicated in his honor. And we were at the opening ceremony in 2002, and in 2008, we were back in Nepal, and I said to Hillary, "Let's swing by your school and see what's going on." So a little surprise visit. And this is what the school looked like when it opened. This is what the school looks like today. Pretty cool. We said to the headmaster, "What happened?" And he said, "Well, we had 200 students show up, then we had 250, then we had 300, then we had 350. So we were overcrowded." And I asked the headmaster, "Did Room to Read help you?" And he said, "You didn't have to help us. You helped us last time. We got the land donated. The parents knew they had to donate labor. We use the same blueprint." And I said, "Yeah, but what about the money? What about the building materials? How did you buy them?" And the headmaster explained that this poor, lost Italian trekker had stumbled upon their village. And the headmaster said, "Hey, we can go from this to this for 20,000 euros. And the headmaster closed the deal. Finally, my last story from the field is about a little girl named Pradipa in Sri Lanka, from a rural area called Kandy, the hill country where the tea leaves are picked, from an illiterate family. She won our young storytelling competition in Sri Lanka 2 years ago with a story she wrote, and her 17-year-old friend illustrated, called Baby Fish Goes to School. This is a beautiful book. I'm going to do something that probably nobody's ever done to you before. I'm going to read you a children's book to close. So I ask you to suspend disbelief as I tell you. I won't read the whole book to you, but I will tell you this story, which is published in Tamil, Sinhalese, and in English. The kids can read it in three different languages. Baby fish is by the side of the pond, and it sees the rabbit go by and asks the rabbit, "Why are you so happy?" And the rabbit explains, "I just came from school. It's a really happy place. We sing songs, we dance, we play games, we read books, we eat rice, we take naps. Wonderful." And the baby fish says, "That's great. I want to go to school too." So the baby fish tells its mother its news. "I want to go to school." And the mother says, "Well, you can't go to school." "Well, why not?" "Because the school's on land, and you're a fish." So it's a story at its heart about exclusion. And we know that if you're a girl born in Sri Lanka, living in a rural area, you know what exclusion feels like. We have a saying at Room to Read, GSD, get shit done, don't talk, act. Fortunately, our rabbit friend is a very GSD, floppy-eared rabbit. And he comes up with a solution. He goes out and finds a fishbowl and scoops up baby fish, and there's a little animal parade. They take baby fish to school. They plunk down baby fish next to the chalkboard, and voila, baby fish goes to school. I told that story 2 years ago at the Clinton Global Initiative in New York when I spoke on the education panel, and out in the front table, I saw Toni Morrison crying, Nobel laureate crying. And I thought about the power of these kids, that what's up here in their brains is so powerful, and if it can be catalyzed and if that energy can be released, it can change their lives forever. So we now have over 20 kids who are authoring books. We have over 300 books we've published in local languages, so kids can then have literacy in their own language. So let's just close with scale. We have a very strong track record of results. We're very proud of our local teams. What started with one library in Bahundanda has grown exponentially. We now have about 7,000 girls on long-term scholarships in the Girls Scholarship Program. That will grow this year to about 9,500 girls. We're very passionate about this program. I get more passionate about it every day when I read about things like acid attacks on girls in Afghanistan and Bangladesh because they're being told by these forces of darkness that girls should not go to school. And every time I read a story like that, I vow to myself that we are going to win this battle of ideology. Anybody who tells little girls they shouldn't go to school, we have to oppose them with every fiber of our being because they can win or we can win. I got to tell you, I think it should be us. Secondly, schools. 765 schools opened to date using the Challenge Grant model, connecting a Western investor, whether it be Goldman Sachs or Credit Suisse or Barclays or Starbucks or Qualcomm, with a community which is dedicated to building a school, running a school, and maintaining a school. This is a huge number, and I try to reduce that to what does it actually mean, 765 schools. To me, what it means is that every day, 150,000 little people wake up, and they have a place to go. They have a desk and a chair and a library and a teacher waiting for them. These kids, like Devi Taru, have known a lot of tragedy. These are kids in Sri Lanka who were in a village that had been wiped out by the tsunami, and they actually moved the fishing village 10 kilometers inland because they now feared the sea. These kids have known civil war, but they've also known the happiness of putting on their school uniform. It looks like they kind of borrowed their ties from an 80s band, doesn't it? But 150,000 little people going to school. Now, I mentioned 250 million kids not going to school, so we have our work cut out for us. And then finally, over 7,000 libraries have been opened. This number will grow to 9,000 this year. I love this picture because this little tyke is obviously inculcating in his stuffed animals the habit of reading. This kid gets it, that everyone should read, including the stuffed animals. That network has grown. That number of books has grown to 5 million books, half of which are in local languages through our award-winning local publishing program. Social entrepreneurs are not afraid to take on risks. We were told early on that we would never be able to publish books in the local languages because the parents can't afford books, so the publishers don't publish, so there's no local language publishing industry. With a grant from the Skoll Foundation, we started with 10 books in the Nepalese language, local authors, local artists. We are scaling this program to massive, massive, massive heights. In only 5 years, we've gone from 10 titles to over 300. 5 million books, to put this in perspective, the tallest building in the world is the Burj Dubai. If you stacked 5 million children's books on top of each other, it would be 13 Burj Dubais. And I know that because last year we launched an initiative with a charity called Dubai Cares, where Sheikh Mohammed challenged the students of the United Arab Emirates to read 1 million books during a 17-day readathon. and said, if you can read 1 million books, we will give Room to Read enough money to print 1 million local language books. We told the kids that would be taller than the Burj Dubai. And then we went and we pitched MR, the company that owns the Burj Dubai, and got them to actually light the Burj Dubai up floor by floor by floor to track the students' progress. That's entrepreneurship. We actually turned the world's tallest building into the world's tallest fundraising thermometer. The kids in the UAE read 1.3 million books. We call it the Million Book Challenge. One of my goals, and I'll throw this out there, is that every city, every big city will have a Million Book Challenge. Small towns will have Million Book Challenges. Greenwich, Connecticut, Dallas, Houston, Austin. We could do this everywhere. Parents love it because it gets their kids to read, it gets their kids to be quiet, and it teaches their kids not to take books in their library for granted. So 5 million books, and then finally about 3 million kids, 3.1 million kids is our best estimate, have access to this network of schools and libraries. Our goal is to reach 10 million students by the year 2020. We're well on our way to that. We actually will hit that earlier than 2020 if we can stay on our current trajectory. To do that, we need your help. I do hope you'll invest in us. I don't want to do a heavy pitch. What I do want to do is plant the seed to say to you, it's not about myself or my team. It's about how big of a network can we create? How many leaders can we get involved in Room to Read? Can we get groups that adopt the Girls Scholarship Program? Can we get groups that decide to build schools and go visit them? Bob Wright and I were talking earlier about potentially doing kind of a Texas trek to one of our countries and bring people from across Texas to go see Room to Read's work and to hopefully get involved. We do want to invite you to be part of this if this touches you, because we want to create the world's largest army of leaders who adopt this as their cause. And I want to invite any one of you to get involved in this. We need Texas on our side. You all have big hearts here. You all have big ambitions here. And we got a lot of support from around the world. We want to have more from here in Texas. The challenge is not that great. It's not that expensive to set up a school. It's not that expensive to set up a freestanding library. We have a challenge grant during the month of March from one of our investors in New York, who's just with me in Laos, that any school or library or girls' scholarship that's endowed in Laos is being matched by them dollar for dollar up to $1 million. So if you're so moved to donate, we'd love to get you to donate. If you're not so moved to donate, no problem with that. There's other things you can do to help us. Tell your friends. Leave here with 10 copies of my book. They're already signed. And you get the author price. You get 10 bucks as opposed to 16. But tell your friends about Room to Read, or put the book in the hands, or if you want to host a party, or if your business does something philanthropically, or if you want to get your family involved, if you want to get your kids involved through our Students Helping Students program. There's several people in this room who have been very supportive. Mary has been incredibly supportive. Patty and Kevin are responsible for bringing us here. Patty and Kevin O'Meara, and Patty is in the back table over there. Stephanie Scott from our team is at the front table. She came down from San Francisco. Bob, I don't know if I was allowed to announce the Texas trek idea, but if you're interested in kind of the Texas trek, we invented that about 30 minutes ago as true entrepreneurs. But if you're interested, we can't guarantee we're going to do it, but if you're interested, tell Bob and I. And I'll close with just the invitation to visit our work, to be present at a school the day it opens, to cut the red ribbon, to bring your kids, to teach your kids about philanthropy, to have family adventure travel. To meet the kids, and then every one of those projects has a dedication plaque so you can honor a loved one. In the same way that I honored my parents, you can choose to actually set something up where people will know something's been done in their honor. And then the Girls Scholarship Program, you can scale that number up or down and try to help us to reach a lot more of these girls, like these charming young girls in Laos who are on their way to school. I'll close with this question. What is the most optimistic image you can imagine? I ask this question because I believe the world is in need of optimism. And all of us have been anointed as leaders. We're amongst the top 1% of the top 1%. And I think the world needs all of us to be what I call action-oriented optimists, to be getting out there and doing everything in our power. So many of you are doing great things in your community, doing great things overseas. It's very, very inspiring. My hope is that all of us will just reach deep, get ready for the next 10 years, and dedicate ourselves to going bigger and bigger and bigger and better and better and better, because a lot of these people out there are counting on us as the leaders of our community to do as much as we humanly can. So thank you for your attention, and I will leave you before Q&A with one closing thought. Thank you very, very much.
So we have a couple minutes. We are running over, but we want to give the
Sorry.
Audience... That's okay.
I get excited, but I can't stop talking.
Very important. We want to give the audience a couple minutes to ask... ask any questions you might have, and maybe you'll also be available afterwards.
I'll stick around.
Okay. Go ahead.
I apologize for going over, but...
It's okay.
It was definitely worth it. Quick question. You talked about scale, which is a very difficult concept, I think, for some nonprofits to grasp. There are about three times as many nonprofits today as there were in 1990. There's a lot of duplication going on in that. Just here in Dallas alone, we have several dozen food pantries, for example.
Yeah.
Everyone employs an accountant, everyone employs a fundraiser, and everyone drives a truck to the food bank. What is the way that we can get more nonprofits to work either collaboratively or to develop more of this kind of argument you have on scale, and then to get philanthropists to agree with that?
That's a fantastic question. What we try to do wherever we can is find ways we can partner with NGOs so that they can do their thing and we can do their thing and we can hopefully work together. So if you run a great orphanage and your orphanage doesn't have books, we're happy to put a library in your orphanage so you don't have to actually set up your own library system. If you run an orphanage or perhaps a children's group and you have kids who don't go to school, we actually will layer our scholarship program along with that. Don and Terry, who are in the room, who've done a school in Nepal, we said to them, we're going to give you as many of our local language books as we possibly can so that you don't have to go figure out how to do your own books. So we're very open to collaboration. And we have those numbers that we showed are only possible because we have literally hundreds of NGO partners around the world that we try to work with and collaborate with. We also are trying to kind of have Room to Read eventually kind of become the roll-up vehicle, if you will, that rather than having, you know, a gazillion education charities in the developing world, our hope is that we'll become large enough that we can leverage that back end and have only one CFO, have only one accounts payable clerk, but have them. And it's just numbers coming in, right? So whether the invoice is for X or 100X, it's still the same invoice. So our hope is that we will grow to be the market leader. We actually already are the market leader in what we do. We hope to take this, though, to the same scale that when you think of disaster relief, you think of Mercy Corps or Doctors Without Borders. We hope that when people think about education in the developing world, that Room to Read will be the trusted global brand that comes to mind. So our goals are to expand into East Africa. We're currently only in two countries in sub-Saharan Africa. We hope to go into East Africa, and we hope to go into Latin America also.
Thank you.
Thanks.
Any other questions? Okay, thank you. Please give him another round of applause. We have one more.
Just a quick question about working in the international sphere. How do you guys handle things like school fees and equal access to education? Because those are issues that are popping up as people move into different countries and affect each country differently.
Yeah, so the school fee issue is left up to the village. We ask each village to show us how their school can be self-sustaining from day one, because we don't want to be in the business of running schools. We want to be in the business of catalyzing the creation of schools. In some communities, the government can provide enough support for the teachers that they don't have to charge fees. In some communities, they do have to charge fees, and it might be $2 a month or $5 a month to support the teacher's salaries. We're agnostic on that. What we ask each village to show us is their plan so that the school can be self-sustaining from the moment it opens, and different communities will do that in different ways. And sometimes it's a matter of they pass the hat to the parents and get the parents every month to put additional money in to help pay the teacher's salaries. Some schools that are well-run, some governments that have their act together, will actually be able to pay enough for the resources that they don't have to charge fees. But that's actually a local decision they make. Got a jump on the mic.
Hi, it was great to be here and an opportunity to hear you speak. And I'm speechless that you're actually coming to East Africa because I'm from Uganda.
And excellent.
If you want a volunteer, I'm signing up because I've been trying to find a way to build a library at my original elementary school. And if there's any way we can work together, it would be awesome.
It is a deal. towards that end, if you're religious, pray for us, because we actually right now are involved in a negotiation with a really large foundation and a really large consortium of high net worth donors who want us to go into East Africa, to Tanzania, Uganda, and Kenya, where the Aga Khan Development Foundation is running a brilliant teacher training program. We're trying to figure out whether or not we can layer our library program in so that every one of those Aga Khan-trained teachers would then have a Room to Read library, which helps us because the teacher quality is higher. It helps them because they have a library. So we are in the early stages of that discussion. A philanthropist named Jim Gray out of Canada, wonderful gentleman, is spearheading those talks between Room to Read and the Aga Khan and his donor network. So we'll get your card, but I would hope that one day you and I will be together in Uganda opening a library. Or perhaps 100 of them.
That's great. Any others? Okay, with that, let me ask you to give him another round of applause.
Thank you.
So before we close, I want to first of all encourage you to buy Leaving Microsoft to Change the World today. He was gracious enough to autograph each of the copies, and so that's a way that you can spread the word, pass it on to some of your friends. I also need to thank a few folks here in the room. I want to thank our collaborating hosts, as Brent mentioned earlier. My partner in crime on this was Pam Gerber to help coordinate the planning behind it with the Entrepreneurs Foundation of North Texas, Leslie Martinelli, and Mary Jelonek with the Dallas Foundation. Thank you so much. The Dallas Women's Foundation, the Communities Foundation of Texas, and of course, my Philanthropy Education Committee with Dallas Social Venture Partners. There's also a number of Kellogg School of Business alumni in the room. I want to welcome you. Did anyone come? Yay. Okay, a number is number one. But that was a good plug for their school. And most importantly, I want to thank our DSVP partners, Jennifer and Chris Lelash, for their generosity in underwriting this event for us today through the Mary Keese Lelash Foundation, which will allow us to use the proceeds from today's lunch to give back to Room to Read. So thank you very much for that. And finally, I want to say, and YPO, excuse me, I have to thank you to Patricia O'Mara and to also Mary Lehman for both also helping us, and Ellen Wood for helping us think through all the logistics of today. So finally, I want to say two things, what I know and what I see. What I know is what I deal with every day. It's the social venture partner network that I get to see of young, budding social entrepreneurs who are working to not only give back to the community, but use their business skill set and talents to help strengthen those organizations that we serve. What I see is a room of people who are leaders in our community, who are able to give back and think uniquely and entrepreneurially about the challenges that face our own community as well as around the globe. And so I want to thank you for taking the time to be here today and hear this important message. And I again want to thank John Wood for being here. Thank you.